Hi, it's Dr. Lisa, and it's time for Dr. Lisa Gives a Shit. I'm thinking about you. I give a shit. Do you have a headache? You know, I had such a headache when I woke up this morning because it's really damp out, but at least it's not that blaring hot thing that got going for quite some time. So I'm really excited to be here at Radio Free Brooklyn, the greatest station in the Western Hemisphere. And please go to our page, our website, www.radiofreebrooklyn.com, and the Patreon page, and donate some money, like even like a buck. Like, you could put in a buck a month, and like, we would love you. We would appreciate that a lot more than like, say, probably any election campaign that you would donate to. That's like, a dollar wouldn't be nothing to them. So just donate to us. I don't care who you're going to vote for. Just give us money. Okay. Okay. Back to us here at the radio station, Radio Free Brooklyn, that is, if I haven't said that too many times. So I have this really fantastic guest for you folks today. And some of you, I can see from the Facebook response, are well aware that I have Paul D'Agostino on. So say hi, Paul.
Hello, everyone.
See, Paul, are you handcuffed to that chair or what?
Yeah, I am, but it's not that uncomfortable, actually. It's surprisingly ergonometric over here with these handcuffs.
Really? You're okay? You think maybe you'll stay the whole time?
I think so. I mean, I tried picking the lock, and it's not that easy, so I'll probably be here for a while.
Oh, okay. That's how we have to handle the guests here sometimes. So, anyway, it's really hard for me to exactly sum up what Paul does, although a lot of you already know, in this space of an entire hour, because it's a really, really long list. So, Paul, you can jump in and correct me if I get any of this wrong, but I'm going to try.
No, you're right. It's kind of a long list.
It is a long list.
Sorry.
Okay, so here's the thing about Paul, is that he's probably certainly the most educated. I think he's probably the most, I'm going to go out on a limb and say he's probably the most educated and certainly accomplished as far as, you know, intellectual pursuits than my other 62 guests.
Oh,
so
man, I don't know.
I wish that was more of a compliment, Paul.
Yeah,
but okay. But here's the thing. Like, Paul is a PhD, so he's actually Dr. D'Agostino, right, Paul?
Yep, that's correct.
Does anyone ever call you Dr. D'Agostino?
Sometimes, but it usually sounds like they're kidding.
Oh, yeah. An ironic way?
Yeah, like, doctor.
About you teach? How about your students?
No.
Do they call you Paul?
Yeah, I usually prefer just having them call me Paul. Sometimes, okay, if they say professor, I forget to look.
Okay, professor.
Yeah.
Okay, here's the point. What I want you to understand about Paul is that here's a guy who's incredibly accomplished, has all these achievements that I'm going to read to you in a second, but yet he doesn't really presume the position of authority at all, which is very curious to me.
Yeah, in fact, on the contrary, I'm handcuffed right now.
He's a kidder. We don't have it in the budget for handcuffs at a place like this.
Okay.
So let me just read this really fast. Education, PhD, Italian literature, MA, Italian literature, BA European Studies, summa cum laude, Phi Beta Kappa, blah, blah, blah,
blah, blah
British
blah, blah.
Institute, University in Florence, University of Munster, languages, Italian, English, German, French, Spanish, translation skills, Portuguese, Dutch, Latin, director, gallery, art editor, two magazines, Parsons School for the Faculty, Parsons, NYU, NYU Studio School, co-founder and writer after whatever, co-founder, producer, exchange rates, assistant editor, freelance, translator. So, I mean, and the guy's an accomplished artist, just had a solo show this year. So, I mean, so this is what is so interesting to me, okay? I told Paul I was going to talk about this. I've actually learned a lot about Paul just from inviting him on the show, and that's what I wanted to share with you. So, The guy should like think like he's the shit, right? I mean, he's done well in school. He's obviously you know what? The things that Paul is really good at, like this language shit, like you have to be smart. Like you can't like just study that. You have to have a sensibility. You have to have like Paul's got to know he's smart. Paul, do you think you're smart?
I have a hunch that I know a thing or two, but.
Are you how do you feel about being smart? Are you like embarrassed about being smart?
No, but I think it's like anything else, you know, if you have a certain quality or character or something that is laudable to people, it's because you invest time and energy in it. And it's a capacity that I think, you know, a lot of people have, and it's just a matter of caring enough about it.
So you're just a hard worker. That's what you're saying.
Yeah, I would definitely admit and fully claim that I'm a hard worker.
Are you pretty driven?
Absolutely.
Okay. Yes. So I just have to read you this letter, and then we can get past all this crap. This is so hilarious.
But that's important, the hard worker thing. And I say that because that informs probably a lot of the things that you're going to ask me about.
Yeah, I mean, I think it is really rare that anyone really becomes particularly successful without hard work, even though it looks like they make it look easy, but you know, it's never easy. It's never anybody that's really good at something, accomplished at something, whether it be like comedy, music, languages, art, usually has put in the 10,000 hours as Malcolm McDowell, right?
And the older you get in different kinds of endeavors, whether they're creative or intellectual or whatever, the more you realize that anything that comes easy, mm-hmm. again, creative, intellectual, or otherwise, athletic, when it comes easy, it's kind of boring.
I would like some more of that, but you have a point. Okay, so here's the letter I wrote Paul. Hi, Paul. I would love to have you on my radio show. It records live every Thursday, Bushwick, blah, blah, blah. Might you be available any of these dates, blah, blah, blah. We could discuss a bunch of things, including nomenclature. It would be fun. Thanks. Let me know. Okay, so this is the letter I get back, folks.
Uh-oh.
Okay. Hi, Lisa. I am the most boring motherfucker there is, so I'd highly recommend you reconsider your offer. I'd even recommend a bunch of motherfuckers who aren't boring at all. Hell, they're not even motherfuckers. They're nice people with interesting things to say. I'm just the worst thing there is. Even my dreams are boring. That's so true. And it goes on. It does. That's not all. If you're not convinced of all that, then maybe I'll do it. Problem is, it's hard for me to... This is about the scheduling. Blah, blah, blah. We'll look at the dates. And then we go back to more. More like, but thanks for asking me. Even if I think you should have pretty much asked anyone else on the planet instead. And thanks for contributing to nomenclature. Blah, blah, blah. Reply by telling me to go to hell. Grateful all the same, Paul. Paul, that's ridiculous. What were you thinking? Like, where does that come from?
It's a fun way to accept an invitation to something, and I think anybody who knows me enough to get personal emails from me or text messages or anything probably knows that I tend to go on tangents inspired by maybe a first word or sentence, and
And they're fun and amusing and thoughtful. I mean, they're kind of fun. It's fun to get an email like that for sure. But see, also, so what I'm hearing from you now is that was an acceptance letter from you.
I
mean, okay. That makes no sense to me whatsoever.
Well, but I also do think that there are plenty of other more interesting people out there, that's for sure. That's sincere.
Well, I don't know. I feel like I should give it... I forgot to call a number. If anybody has an opinion on this, please call in. 718-928-9898. 718-928-9732. That's 718-928-9732. If you want to, like, if you know Paul or something, or you, but here's the thing. You know, this is a Radio Free Brooklyn in the basement of a bike shop in Bushwick. I am grateful to have someone of your caliber to be on the show.
I'm happy you asked.
No, but
I'm happy to be here.
Well, but the thing is, for me, like, I get so much rejection from asking people to be on the show.
Really?
That, I'm flattered that you're surprised. That I am surprised to, like, I'm confounded. I'm confounded right here in the moment that you meant that as an acceptance letter. I didn't get that at all. I really thought you just didn't want to be on the show.
Oh, well, I apologize. I didn't mean it to be read like that at all. I meant it really to be sincere about, there are a lot of interesting people out there, so thanks for asking me. And maybe I thought I'd make you chuckle a little bit while you read my acceptance letter.
Huh. That's so interesting. See, but I have my own Mishigas, so it just pushed my insecurity buttons. Isn't that funny?
Yeah, that is funny. I'm sorry.
No, don't apologize at all. Don't apologize. It's just what I'm just learning right now is that this is what happens. I mean, if you're dealing with somebody neurotic, Paul, maybe what this means is be careful. Or whatever. Or maybe I should lighten up. That's probably what we're learning here. So, anyway, I find that interesting. I was so wrong about that. So, isn't that funny?
Yeah.
Aren't you glad we straightened it out, though?
Yeah. And if you have any other emails of mine that you'd like to read out loud, then...
Please do.
Enough with the emails.
Okay, we...
No, but you can. I think I've sent you other emails.
Yeah, you have. But I felt that was kind of it in a nutshell. Then the other thing that was mysterious that I learned about you from asking you to be on the show was that you sent me a picture that your mother sent you of you doing a handstand.
Just yesterday, she sent me that.
And I find that interesting too. Like, what did she know? Did it have anything to do with the show, or does your mother just generally?
I guess it kind of did have to do with this show because I talked to her a few days ago and, she was asking me what's going on and all that kind of stuff that I usually talk about with my mom. And I usually skirt around really telling her what I'm actually up to because it's often a lot. But this was coming up, so I said, I'm going to be on the radio on Thursday and she had known about this TV thing that happened last week that was kind of funny, and so she thought this was amusing, and so she sent me that yesterday. I think thinking about this weird week so far of various.
Is this related to the TV appearance?
Well, not really. But last week I was asked to be on interviewed for. TV in South Korea.
Oh, yes.
And so I did that interview last week, and it was kind of funny. And
that's so weird and random.
Yeah, funny, haha. It was about North Korea. But anyway.
Really?
Yeah, so I
nothing to do with art.
Nothing at all, actually.
Wow.
I wrote a review earlier this summer of a film called Under the Sun.
Mm-hmm.
That's a documentary by this Russian director named Vitaly Mansky, who made this documentary in North Korea that is relatively subversive and I guess wasn't really supposed to be made the way it was made at all. And anyway, so
right.
I wrote a review of it for Brooklyn Magazine, and there's this South Korean... interest in it, obviously, and they are putting together some kind of news report about the film and about its reception, and they wanted to talk to an expert critic, and I thought it was funny that they referred to me as an expert critic.
See, yeah.
So I said, yeah, sure, you can come over and interview me. I'll talk about that movie.
Oh, that's funny. So your mom must be very proud of you, I'm guessing.
I guess. I think that also increasingly she has no idea what I do or why and that kind of thing. Which is okay. I don't mind confusing.
Yeah. What did your parents do?
Both of my parents were educators. They're both very recently retired.
And where are they from? Where did you grow up?
I grew up in Virginia Beach.
Oh, nice.
I was born in New Jersey, mm-hmm. in Hackettstown, New Jersey.
Mm-hmm.
And then we moved around a lot when I was a kid. And I have two sisters, so my sisters were my best friends and kind of still are.
Mm-hmm. Older, younger?
3 years older and 3 years younger. So
right, you're a middle child.
Yeah, that'll probably give you insight into something.
I don't know. Well, what I am really focused on is how somebody that I want to find out about your background, because I do find it unusual that somebody with the kind of academic and mm-hmm. also media credentials that you have, you know, writing for all the papers, and mm-hmm. you have a lot of authority, but yet you laugh at it. So, I mean, there are a lot of, you know, this is just going to be so sexist of me to say this, but there are a lot of men, particularly, uh-huh. in your situation that would be really bossy. They would be using it in the other, that's my impression of, I am not an academic person, but that's my, and, you know, that's my impression of uh-huh. the stereotype of academic and also, you know, curator. Why am I comfortable with you? Why am I not afraid of you? That's what I'm trying. This is what I want to find out.
I'm not that tall, I guess.
Some of the short ones are the worst, and you know that.
Yeah, Napoleon.
Oh, God. I had a boss once who is definitely shorter than you, and he was the scariest person I ever worked for. So let's find out about your background. So why did you move out around so much?
My mom wanted to stop teaching and be home with my older sister when my older sister was born.
Mm-hmm.
And so she did that. But my dad was also a teacher.
Wait,
at the time.
Oh, you mean the first baby?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So my parents were both teachers.
And what kind of teaching did they do? What level?
Well, my mom taught various levels. Preschool and also third grade, fifth grade.
Children.
And my dad taught mostly high school. He did a little bit of part-time teaching at some community colleges mm-hmm. as well, and then he was mm-hmm. at high schools, and then they both ended up principals of schools.
Right, so they were authority figures. Yeah. So they were both like, they're school teachers.
Yeah, yeah.
Mm-hmm. In every sense of the word.
Education was always a big deal in our family.
Right. And you're Italian?
Yep, both sides.
Yeah, see, I thought us Jews had that covered. I thought that, look at this.
Well, both sides are actually from the same part of Italy, from the same region.
Really?
From Abruzzo, yeah.
Oh, were your parents both born here?
Yeah, my parents were born here. Mm-hmm. And on one side, my grandfather came over, and on the other side, it was my great-grandparents who came over.
Mm. So why all the traveling? Did they go?
Well, because you know, teachers' salaries like may or may not be good these days. I don't really know. As a part-time professor, I can't really say anything about having a real salary. But then I don't think they were awfully wonderful.
And, no.
So having one teacher's salary and a family that kept growing, because then a few years later I came around, and then a few years after that mm-hmm. my younger sister came around, meant that my dad had to get different kinds of jobs and stuff. So they, you know, I think in a very brave way they moved according to necessity and opportunity. And then we ended up in Virginia Beach when I was, I guess, six.
Mm.
And then that's where I grew up. So really my hometown is really
so once Beach. You moved there, they kind of said, okay, that's enough.
Yeah, we moved around to a bunch of different homes in Virginia Beach, with mm-hmm. which is, you know, with hindsight and everything, it's kind of cool to think about. It was a constant adventure.
Oh, did you change schools or just?
Yeah, I changed schools.
Oh, well, then that is a lot. Change schools, it doesn't matter if it's a block away or 12. You know, that's so what was that like?
Changing schools all the time. You know, the real virtue of all of that. I mean, it's a little bit weird to have a different elementary school every year. You're in elementary school.
Really? Was it like that. Was it really? I mean, was
yeah,
it really?
It was very frequent. And, you know, I guess what's a further aspect of that is that it was a time when Virginia Beach was growing dramatically. The population was skyrocketing, and there was there's always been a big military presence there. And my family didn't have anything to do with the military presence there, but we moved there at around the time when a lot of bases were being I don't know if they were being broadened or some of them were new at the time, but so the population was really increasing quickly while we were there, and it meant that the general area for every school was actually pretty small. So you could move just, you know, maybe a 5-minute drive down the road somewhere, and it meant a completely different school district.
And also, military families are known for moving a lot. Were you involved? I mean, were your friends?
Oh, yeah.
Your friends. So it's kind of like, it's kind of ironic, isn't it, that you sort of went with the flow with the other kids, and they were all used to moving. Is that right?
Well, yeah, exactly. I mean, that's a question that a lot of people ask me when if I talk about growing up. We moved around a lot. Someone will say, "Was your family military?"
Yeah, right. Of course.
Sort of general characteristic. And no, we weren't military. However, we lived in Virginia Beach, which was military.
That is so weird.
Yeah.
Do you think your parents were influenced by that? They were like, hey, the neighbors are moving all the time. Let's move, too. Look at these kids. They just move them around. Let's just keep going.
I think they were just so driven by necessity and doing what they thought was best for us as kids that it didn't really matter to them to try to do something for any other reason.
No, they were trying to feed. And your mom was a stay-at-home mom, were you saying?
She was until when my younger sister was born. My mom went back to work maybe a few years after my younger sister was born. So she left teaching for about 10 years to be with us.
Yeah.
And then she went back to teaching.
But you had your older, you had your sister, so that's good.
Yeah,
right?
And the flip side to all of that moving around and everything was that my best friends were my sisters, and I don't know if I was their best friend, but anyway.
Let's find out.
I don't know. Yeah.
We hadn't
a ton of choice, so we were always together, hanging around at home, drawing pictures and telling stories to each other and stuff like that. I mean, sounds corny, but
no, it doesn't. It sounds actually really nice. So that's a positive side of it. How was school for you? Like, did you just focus? Did you always do well in school when you were a kid?
Yeah.
Do you think it's partly because your parents were teachers? I used to feel like that. They get help,
What was great about. I don't know if they were aware of it, because, I mean, thinking about it now, they were young. They were much younger than I am now, and I wouldn't really know how to go about the kind of parenting that they kind of seemed to know intuitively. But they didn't force school on us in any real way. It was just a sort of understood thing. You know, like, you don't really have to, you don't have to force lunch on anybody, really. But, like, you know, it just
maybe it was
a normal thing.
And yeah, so, you probably inherited. You know, it probably just makes sense the way, you know. There's probably things that you probably wouldn't even necessarily notice, like, you know, probably a lot of children's books being read to you and things like that. You know, you're from a family that valued education, so maybe they didn't actually. Were you pretty self-disciplined then?
I really liked to do well in school, because then I had great reasons to misbehave and things like that. I did learn at an early age a lesson that maybe wasn't great for me to learn, but I learned that if you did well enough in school and got really great grades and everything, you could get away with stuff. If I did something...
What would you do that was bad?
Oh, I did a lot of bad stuff.
Really?
I did a lot of bad stuff.
I didn't know that.
I'm not just talking about when I was a little kid. I did a lot of bad stuff.
What? As an adolescent?
I grew up skateboarding. I skateboarded for a long time, and I still skateboard a little bit. So really, I've skateboarded a lot longer than,
You were an early adapter.
Yeah, I guess so. But the thing about skateboarding is that every time I went skateboarding with my friends somewhere, we were basically trespassing. We were basically destroying property. You know, it wasn't really permitted in most of the places we did it. And we did it for hours and hours, every day of the week, all night.
Did you ever get in trouble?
Yeah.
Like what? Like the cops?
Cops.
Did your parents know?
Yeah, my parents knew.
So were they like, Paul's a bad seed? Uh-oh.
Well, it was just, no, not a bad seed. I mean...
Because the seed was obviously good. But no, were they worried about you?
Yeah, they were constantly worried about me because, you know, the other thing about skateboarding is that you get hurt all the time, every day.
Oh,
you
right.
You get hurt in one way or another.
And, right.
Yeah, I don't know how they put up with me, really. I would be horrified if I had me as a child coming home bleeding all the time and, you know, talking about getting reprimanded by the police and things like that. And
what about your sisters?
My sisters were, I guess they were a little bit more adventurous than I was in terms of kind of other sorts of social behavior.
Like sex?
Oh, I don't know. No.
What do you mean by that?
Well, they were, you know, they were better at enjoying other things like
movies.
Yeah, I guess so.
More parties?
Yeah, partying.
Oh,
stuff
so
like
your social life was hanging out with like the skateboarding kids?
Yeah, I mean that's
the rebellious. That's pretty much rebellious. Was there cigarette smoking and shit like that?
Oh, you know, skateboarders are pretty famous for doing
cigarettes,
all kinds of stuff,
all that other kind of shit,
yeah.
Alcohol.
I mean, look, you're practicing a sport where the basic tendency is to fall on the ground and get hurt.
Yeah,
and so everything else is kind of minor in comparison.
Right.
But
yes.
I didn't really engage with any of that stuff. I was very serious with skateboarding as well. You know, it wasn't a social thing for me. It was really a sport. It was an athletic endeavor, and I wanted to excel at it. And so,
mm-hmm.
you know, as a scene, it contains all kinds of different approaches to seriousness of skateboarding. But
mm-hmm.
I had a cluster of friends who were my age or around my age, and we were really serious about
it.
Did
you get really good at it?
I did, and I competed, mm-hmm. and
professionally?
Well, no,
or
I
semi-professionally,
mean,
well,
semi, because you know there were amateur contests and stuff that I skated in all the time, and there were East Coast championship contests.
Really?
I skateboarded in.
So how far did you get?
Well, I got up to like second, fifth place, third place in a bunch of contests. Every contest I skateboarded in, I placed.
Did you travel?
Within Virginia, yeah.
Yeah.
Never really outside.
So were your
Virginia.
Parents proud of that?
There might have been one in North Carolina at some point.
Were your parents proud of that?
Yeah, but they were worried about it. And again, this goes back to the school thing. Because I did really well in school, they were willing to accept what I was doing with skateboarding, how much time I was spending skateboarding.
Right.
Because anyway, I was getting straight A's. So, you know, very young, I figured out how to, get straight A's while spending not minimal, but basically minimal amount of time doing homework, and so I could have the rest of the time.
Because it's true. You have a lot of native intelligence. Let's just say it. So do you think that maybe school was fairly easy for you? Maybe easier than some of the other kids?
It was easy, and to be candid, I loved it. I always loved school, and I still do. I mean, I teach. I'm basically in school. I've always loved
you like the orderliness of it, or just the pursuit, or
the pursuit. I mean, I like knowing stuff. I like learning new stuff, and teaching is still that. Teaching is a matter of
learning new
sharing stuff that you know, and learning stuff back. I mean, I learn stuff from my students all the time.
So you have a really good memory too, or is it more like an interest and therefore the memory? I mean, you're able to retain. See, I'm envious. Not envious, but it's just magical to me. You were able to retain a lot of information.
Yeah. I have a small head, but I think I have a sticky brain.
That's well put. So what happened when you transitioned from high school to college?
I didn't have real plans to go to college.
Why not?
To the chagrin of my, my teachers and counselors or whatever in high school. I wanted to keep pursuing skateboarding. I mean, it was at that age where, for a lot of skateboarders in Virginia, in places like Virginia Beach, especially the East mm-hmm. Coast, at that time, if you wanted mm-hmm. to pursue skateboarding, it kind of meant going out to California and mm-hmm. getting involved with the scenes out there, because you could skateboard year round and. That's just where the industry was at the time.
You know, it's kind of interesting because, like, it seems like the logical path that you might have taken would have had to do with something to do with, you know, doing well in school, because there's so many opportunities.
Here's what happened. So I wanted to do that. That was my plan. My parents were sort of were embittered about it, for sure, because I was graduating at the very top of my class in high school, and I had straight A's and everything, and I was very, very proud of that. I mean, it wasn't something that I took for granted at all. But I was really serious about skateboarding. And then in the fall of my senior year of high school, I fell. I took a really, really hard fall, I busted myself up in a very serious way.
What
that
happened?
I tried to conceal.
What? Like, what happened?
Well, I fell from a certain height going very fast and doing a trick that involved moving backwards through the air.
Oh, my God.
And I just kept going. My board got clipped on what I was going over. Mm-hmm. And for aficionados out there, it was a backside 180 over a crate. And you know, I was going fast, and my board got clipped, and I fell. And I've fallen a million times, and we've all fallen a million times, the scene of skateboarding with. And, you know, I fell, and I hit my tailbone first on the pavement. And mm-hmm. it was total pain. But, you know, my friend's reaction was, oh, get up. You know, we laughed, and I kind of rolled off to the side of the street for some reason, the most comfortable position I could find was perched up against a dumpster. So it was behind a Kmart. And I rolled over to the dumpster and just sort of perched myself there. There was like a place that I put my elbow on the dumpster that made my tailbone.
You know,
hurt.
It's great when there's a dumpster when you need one, right?
So I busted myself up really, really bad. I tried as hard as I could to conceal the injury, but I couldn't sit. I had a bruise from the back of my knees mm-hmm. to the middle of my back. It was gross.
So in the moment, you were in pain, or was it shock? I mean, how bad was it? Were you trying to trying to be a cool guy, like a teenager, I don't want my friends to know, or like what happened there?
No, it wasn't that I didn't want my friends to know. We all knew about each other's injuries. That was no big deal. Yeah. I always had to conceal injuries from my parents so that they wouldn't, you know, get mad.
So is that what happened? You were trying to, you were saying you had to conceal from your parents.
Yeah, I mean, whenever I got hurt really bad, I didn't mm-hmm. want them to know, because they would be right.
Oh, so there's sort of like a rebellious streak.
Kind of, but if I had gotten hurt bad enough, they also probably wouldn't want me to go skateboarding.
Right, that's what you were probably really genuinely afraid of?
Well, yeah, I mean, and I skateboarded through every injury that I had until this one.
And then what happened?
I could barely walk.
So what happened? Did you try to, like, how long did it take for you to not be able to hide it? Did you go to school?
I went to school. I mean, I was capable of playing it off like, mm-hmm. you know, like a normal injury. Mm-hmm. I didn't go to a doctor for it or anything. Mm-hmm. I couldn't skateboard. And that was the first time that, you know, days went by, and then a couple weeks went by, and then you know, it was devastating, because it was the first time. Well, devastating. At that time, it was the first time in 8 or so years that I had even gone more than a couple of days without skateboarding.
No, it must have been weird.
And even a couple of days was, you know, devastating.
A lot.
Devastating to us at the time.
Well, the feeling of not being able, that's a big, big, you know, block on your freedom.
Uh-huh. Yeah, so I had this terrible injury, and it was also deadlines were coming to apply for college, so I thought, I guess I better use these good grades and apply to college.
Ah.
And,
uh,
so
That's how you wound up going to college? Did you tell your parents? Or I thought that's how the story was going to end with you, like, in the hospital and then having to come clean about it.
No, I mean, they knew about it later on. I mean, at some point, they realized that I hadn't been skateboarding in a while, and that was as devastating for them to witness as it was for me to...
What do you mean? What do you mean they felt bad for you? Is that what you're saying?
I don't know if they... I guess to some extent they felt bad because I wasn't really happy about it, but it was an interesting time because all of a sudden I wasn't spending the many hours a day that I used to spend doing this one activity. I always had part-time jobs, and so it wasn't going skateboarding after getting off work at 1 a.m. or midnight or something at some restaurant and going skateboarding afterwards. There were things that I all of a sudden wasn't doing anymore.
So did it change your life, that accident?
Yeah, absolutely.
And how did it affect you? Were you able to go back to skateboarding or never at that same level?
Not the same level. It was six months before I could stand on my skateboard and push without it hurting. And, you know, the basic trick that you need for skateboarding is to ollie, which is, you know, the thing that looks like a jump with the board. And it hurts so bad to come down from an ollie.
But you never went to the doctor?
No, I didn't. I had heard that a tailbone injury is something that you can't really do anything about. You have to just take it easy and let it heal.
Looking back at it now, do you think that was sensible or?
I don't have any.
I have no clue.
I have zero sensible approaches to injury or being sick.
Oh, okay. I'm asking the wrong person.
Yeah, you're asking the wrong
person. Did you have to keep your parents at a distance then?
No.
Did you?
No.
How about your sisters?
My younger sister was actually the only person who saw part of the... she saw part of the huge bruise that I had. She was the only one who probably really knew about
So were your parents pretty supportive of you?
Yeah, they were. And then, you know, they weren't happy about this injury thing, but they were definitely happy that I was going to be going to college. And what I learned through all of that is that... skateboarding got me a PhD.
Oh. So did you feel, do you ever think like you never got to like find out about your dream or any of that? Is there any of that in there?
Well, you know, I mean, I was able to skateboard again and, you know, especially, you know, my first year of college, you know, I skateboarded around campus and stuff and I was able to get a lot of my tricks back, but I didn't have the same, I didn't have the kind of time to devote to it that I used to have. But the reason I say it got me a PhD is because to maintain all of those hours of skateboarding when I was younger, while getting really great grades in school, and being really serious about both. I mean, I loved both. So and also I was in a lot of art schools at the time. Mm-hmm. So I took all of these things with the same amount of seriousness. And because skateboarding was such a devotion of time, I had to get those other things done in an efficient way. And I had to figure out how to study hard and study well without it taking much time.
Right.
And so when I was in college, I wasn't spending all those hours skateboarding. And I was studying a lot. And I wouldn't say that college was easy or anything, but... I went to a pretty demanding school.
Yeah, what school was it again?
William & Mary.
Oh, yeah, it's a really good school.
Yeah, and they really, you had a lot of work at that school.
So you're so, you definitely have a good sense of humor. We're learning, I learned that. Better than mine. I'm glad to know that. Well, anyway. So we're good. No, but it's you. You're better. No, you're better. No, you're better. So you just have like a lot of drive. Is that just innate? Where do you think that comes from? Is anybody else in your family like that?
Why? Everyone in my family is like that.
Everyone? Do you think it's biological then?
I don't know. I mean, maybe it's genetic. Maybe it comes from these mountains out in Abruzzo where, you know, life is hard and you have to really bust your hump if you're gonna get anywhere.
What did your sisters wind up doing?
Well, They both went to the same art school that I went to. We went to this gifted and talented program when we were little kids, and kind of it was part of the public school system. Mm-hmm. We went all throughout school, mm-hmm. and then they both went on and did BFAs as well. And then my older sister did an MFA, and so they're both also artists. My younger sister now has a fashion line.
Really?
She designs her own clothing, and she also makes visual artwork.
Yeah. Wow. Does she have, like, a business and stuff?
Yep.
She's successful, right?
Yeah, she's successful Jesus. And responsible, and she's a very much more responsible adult than I am.
Much more adult.
Yeah, much more adult.
It's funny. You know, sure. It's funny. It's making me think now that you got now I'm beginning to feel like I'm understanding you in the way that in the way that you're, like, that skateboarding thing is partly like that's you can't take that off. That's like you wear that's who you are, right? Some of that culture, like
I mean,
that's not going anywhere.
Well, it's what you're saying is spot on, but I always had, you know, one foot in all of the. In the door that was full of AP classes and being, you know, doing those kinds of things in school and also being a... So I had this dual profile, I guess, that, you know, was strange. And I didn't mind it. And, you know, in general, I would say that there was a lot more acceptance of the nerdy skateboarder among skateboarders than there was acceptance of the... skateboarder nerd among nerds.
Yeah, like that's what I was thinking about. Weren't the nerds like? What about the nerd teachers? You know,
it's just funny thinking about even like the term nerd. Anymore.
Nerd, I know.
Totally.
Oh, we're gonna get into the language.
Yeah.
Which, you can write me important thing. I want 5-page report on the word nerd by tomorrow. So what is that like for you in academia? I mean, if you have a rebellious streak, don't you just think those people are so uptight? And like, how do you deal with that?
Well, I don't know. I liked that too. I had exposure to a little bit of teaching when I was really young, and I liked the kind of intellectual authority that a lot of academics had, and I liked how some of them really carried it really. Like with a sense of leisure. I had some very important.
So you have some good role models.
I had some great role models as teachers, as art teachers, and as teachers in high school. Uh-huh. And then I had some great role models as professors when I was in school. And really, I think anybody who's in academia, especially anybody who's pursuing a PhD or something, had a professor or two or three that they thought, oh man, I want to share knowledge like that person, so there was room, so
you felt like you could find a place there. Yeah. So what happens now if you feel like, you know, an artist that you're working with or a student or somebody is a slacker? Like, how do you handle it? Do you just like, are you like, how do you handle it?
A slacker? I don't know. You know, I
or
think,
you just avoid them. You can't. That's a part of the planet.
Yeah, I don't. I mean, the best way to encourage a slacker, I think, is to maybe praise what it is that they're doing that they're slacking off on to an extent, and give them critique. I mean, you know, everybody benefits from a little bit of critique. So even if something is really great, if somebody's not putting 100% effort into it, then it could be greater. Therefore, it's not as great as it could be. Therefore, you have something to. Something to impart.
Like my English teacher wrote in my yearbook, a good student who could be great. See how that stuck with me?
Oh, but I'm sure you were also a great student.
No,
right?
I was a real... Oh, are you kidding? I was a C student.
Oh, yeah.
Really bad student. Yeah, really... Yeah, yeah, yeah. Not good in school at all. Not good in... I was really intimidated. I got really intimidated. And also I was not considered bright growing up.
Huh.
So, you know, but, so What does your other sister do? I just wanted to understand if your parents are miffed by, like, how anybody, like, yeah, what does your other sister do?
My other sister is a mother of two young kids. Mm-hmm. One's 3 and a half, my niece, and one is about 8 months now, seven or eight months, my nephew. And Giovanna Domenico.
Oh.
And she is also an artist and hasn't been too involved with shows and stuff like that in a little while.
Because she's a mom.
She's a mom, and she also, she's a kung fu teacher. She's a kung fu instructor.
What?
And has been doing that for a long time.
That's a freak thing.
It's cool. And
that's weird. What a family. I'm trying to picture you guys.
It's
an unusual. Are you guys all really close?
Yeah. We're close.
But your parents must be very open-minded.
Yeah.
And encouraging.
I would say that I don't think they would be too offended to hear me say that they became open-minded. I think that they weren't always quite so open-minded. I think
you got
for
it out
sure
of them.
That 20 years ago, if somebody had said, in 20 years, your three children are going to be up to these things, they might say that sounds interesting, but
so are they
would be stunned.
But they must be are they confused by what you do?
By what and I don't even share.
Do they think like you have a PhD, you've got all this, you know, you've got all this stuff, all these credentials and all these magazines and all the shit, like are they thinking like, why aren't you like running a comp, you know, do they want to see making like a lot more money and wearing, you know, like
new clothes and stuff like that,
like a nice job? Do they want you to have a nice job?
Oh, absolutely, they would love for me to have a nice job. I don't know if I'm opposed to the idea of having a nice job.
So what, like, I mean, I wonder, like, I think you're doing really well. You're young. You're in your 30s?
Toward the end of my 30s.
Yeah. So, like, what do you see in your future? Or do you have a goal other than goals you've already achieved?
I don't know. I've learned that a lot of good things can come from letting things guide you, like letting sort of one...
Mm-hmm. Organically, you mean.
Yeah, just moving along like that, not forcing anything too much. That's the best things have come to me by not forcing anything.
I've kind of started learning that the hard way,
But you know, the hard thing is that sometimes you feel like you're at a point where things are really going to go to some sort of, you know, proverbial next level, and then maybe they don't.
Because it's always frustrating.
Yeah,
is there anything that you could imagine on next level might be?
Oh, geez. I mean, it kind of would be nice to not have so many jobs. I honestly can say
what would a job, like if you could get paid, like on a practical level, not on a fantasy level, like what would be the paying job you might want? Like, would that be a professor? Would that be a gallerist? Would that be a visual painter, artist?
It's a perfect question, really, because there's not really any one of the things that I do that I don't like to do. So I do get to at least say, in honesty, that I really enjoy sincerely the things that I do.
Don't you think doing so many things is probably part of the reason you're not? I mean, I applaud it. I applaud it. I'm not trying to, you know. I mean, but that. Being that kind of person by nature, which you are, is what's getting in the way of a nice job, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
Partly, at least. Yeah.
Absolutely. And, you know, it so happens that a lot of the things that I do are precisely the things that these days are all part of a gig economy.
Right.
Which sucks. It's the worst. Anybody who has a bunch of freelance jobs and, you know, crams a bunch of things in to get by, we all know it's terrible.
What in particular? I mean, I've had mostly... you know, freelance jobs that are more like full-time jobs, but when I'm freelance. So what is particularly bad about it from your point of view?
The terrible thing, I mean, maybe my case is particular, but...
No, I'm curious. I mean, I'm sure a lot of people out there probably feel exactly the same way.
The terrible thing is that it gets praised a lot. And you see a lot of press about how the gig economy is this new thing. Young people are into it. You get to, you know, maybe work at a coffee shop or something, and, you know... work from home sometimes, and, you know, it's interesting because you're never doing the same thing from one week to the next, and That's true when it isn't. I mean, if you're involved in a bunch of freelance stuff, you're kind of always doing the same thing. But it, you have, you know, the stuff isn't, it's not guaranteed that these things are going to come and renew. So you're constantly a little bit, you know, on the lookout for things. You're constantly accepting
things. It's the hustle.
It's
the uncertainty and the hustle combined.
Yeah, and your mind is always in a lot of different places at once, which isn't really a bad thing.
And then, like, what about health insurance?
Exactly. Like, there are the other things that are a natural part.
And what about settling down? Where's your family?
Yeah, yeah.
Where are those? Are you heterosexual?
Yeah,
right?
Yeah. Good.
So
thing
where
I
are?
Don't.
Where are they? Where's the wife
they're
and
right,
kids?
They're right where they could be, which is nowhere. I mean, I wouldn't really be able to maintain the kinds of things that I do, and definitely the sort of pitiful economics of my existence wouldn't be realistic if I had. I have three housemates.
No, but I mean, is that something that you really want at some point?
I don't know.
You don't know.
It's like, well, it's like all the other stuff, you know, it happens or it doesn't.
But,
and, you know.
But I mean, I would say from the outside looking in that your life has had a pretty positive, productive, and somewhat logical progression where all the things that you enjoy doing and are passionate about have had chances to develop and to continue to develop. Is that true?
Yeah. Yeah,
okay, so then fuck it. Fuck
yeah,
it.
Yeah,
yeah, then
exactly.
Fuck it. All right, good.
Exactly.
You know what? We have only less than 10 minutes left.
Oh,
and
man,
I know. And
awful.
I really want to.
So much fun.
I know. And I feel like, you know, I just want to hear more about your folks and shit like that. But you know what?
Well,
I really want to talk about.
They're probably happy to not be addressed anymore.
No. Oh, I don't know.
But hey, Mom. Hey, Dad. Hey, Melissa. Hey, Julie. Hey, Javon. Hey, Domenico.
Do you have a family picture? Can you send me one that we can post? Because I want to see these people.
Sure, I can find that.
I want a kid one and an adult one. I want to see. Do you guys all see each other around Thanksgiving and all that?
No, I usually get to see everybody in the summer. So I got to see everybody earlier this summer.
Family reunion?
No, not really. It's more like Paul shows up at the door of. Well, my younger sister's in Philly. My older sister is in Richmond, and then my dad and stepmom also live in Richmond.
So you don't all get together.
My mom's down in Virginia Beach.
You have to go make a tour.
Sometimes we do, but what I usually do is I make a tour, and I stay at each person's
the
place.
The D'Agostino tour. The D'Agostino family tour. Yeah. That sounds like fun.
Yeah.
So anyway, so let's talk about two projects that are ongoing. One is Nomen Culture.
Uh-huh.
And the other is exchange rates.
Uh-huh.
So I think that I want you to explain it because we don't have a lot of time and I want to make sure that we get everything in and
okay.
You're going to be better at this than I am.
Okay, yeah, absolutely. Well, both things I can sort of talk about through the lens of Centalto, which is this home gallery I've been running since 2008 in my loft. And so they're both different projects that have come out of doing those things. So the Nomen Culture one, which is basically the current Centalto project, is an exhibit that was just at Studio 10. It was so
fantastic.
It was an off-site Centalto show.
Yeah, it was really great.
It's called Thank You, and thank you again for contributing.
Oh God,
and thanks to all the contributors out
143
there.
143 of them, right?
Yeah, 142 contributors and 176 pieces.
Incredible.
And yeah, I mean,
it's a really amazing show.
And it's
really
a real
special.
real cool breadth of contributors too. My 3.5-year-old niece made
really?
Some panels, and you know, lots of people who are more like my parents' age and stuff.
Paul, I'm only saying this to stand your for you. It's
uh-huh.
6 minutes.
Uh-huh. Oh yeah. Well, anyway, so the show is about color mixing colors and naming those colors. So that's what that show was all about. And the first installation just closed at Studio 10, and I'm gonna install it again at Centalto at the home site. For Open Studios, which happens, Bushwick Open Studios, which happens in the first weekend of October. And Nomen Culture will be up there also toward the end of the month when we're doing another iteration of Exchange Rates, which is an international art expo in Bushwick that I developed working with Stephanie Theodore at Theater Art. And
shout out, Stephanie.
Yeah,
she's awesome. Stephanie. Her gallery program's really
great.
Yeah,
she might even be listening. I'm surprised she didn't call in.
She'll be.
And Carl Englund, Charlie Levine, and Ben Street, who are involved with Sluice in London, which is an art fair and kind of variably manifested arts enterprise. They're really great creative folks. And Stephanie and I collaborated with them to put together this international art expo, we call it, in Bushwick, that happened 2 years ago, and it's happening again this October. There are about 45 galleries involved.
Really? Wow.
Yeah, there are about a dozen galleries here in Bushwick that are hosting galleries from abroad or from other places in the U.S. That will be here sharing spaces with the host galleries in Bushwick, and it's going to be a sort of big
festival.
Big, yeah,
really.
Big. I mean, it's
a lot of British, a lot of cute British guys with British accents, huh?
Yeah, maybe.
Maybe.
Know.
Who knows?
Maybe
so
some,
are they coming
maybe
here?
Some cute British girls.
I'm sure. Are they going to come here physically?
Yeah, they're going to come here physically.
How?
Bring
that's
shows.
A huge. I didn't realize how many galleries that was. That's huge.
Yeah, it's going to be great. It's going to be great.
So they're going to sort of like partner with other galleries?
Yeah, I mean.
45? How many galleries here are they going to
so
be?
So it's about 13 or so host galleries here. And some of them are in the Bogart Building, and some of them are near the Bogart Building, and others are spread further around. Like the Buggy Factory is going to be a host site. Enrico Gomez is doing something there. Sardine is going to be involved. So there are some other places that aren't right there. The Brooklyn Fireproof is involved.
Mm-hmm.
And so the host galleries,
huge.
You know, open up a wall or something, part of their space for a visiting gallery or two to put up a show. And so part of the logic of exchange rates is that every space that you visit, you get to visit a Bushwick space. And within that Bushwick space, you're basically also visiting an artist-run enterprise from somewhere much further away.
Wow, that's so cool. Did you go there? I mean, I'm assuming you had an exchange. Bushwick had an exchange over there. Did you go to London?
Well, I mean, we've only had the one exchange rates in 2014.
Oh, okay.
So this is the second one. And we kind of developed the platform with the idea that, over time, these will start to happen in other places, too. You know, there could be an exchange race in Los Angeles or an exchange race Vladivostok or something.
Oh, wow. It's,
hopefully an exchange race.
So is that going to be open during Bushwick Open Studios as well?
It's after Open Studios. It's
That's good because there's too many. Yeah. Too many things
It's a sort of it's almost like an open studios for artist run galleries. That kind of
right
thing.
Right.
So it is very different from a normal art fair in that sense.
Although right.
There are certain aspects of it that have the trappings of art fair, but you know, it's how you conceive of something.
Yeah, and I also wanted to something that I think I wanted people to know about color. You say it.
Nomenclature. Yeah.
That I think is so interesting is that when you reinstall it, it's going to be a complete. It's so. It's 142 different. Six by six squares. So you can install it in any way, and so the next it will have a different personality to some degree.
Yeah, it's totally different. I mean, in Studio 10 is big, so I got to do this big arc, two stripes with the panels. And at my place, my only choice really is to make a big grid, which is what a lot of people expected. You know, a lot of people said, I thought you were going to just do a big grid. And I said, well, I will, because at my place, I'm not going to be able to do anything else.
It kind of makes it a living thing, which is really cool. So
even
if you did see it at Studio 10, it's going to be a very different, I imagine it'll be pretty. Are you going to keep the colors? Was there a lot of work working out the colors?
There was a lot of cataloging and making a list and checking it twice.
No, but I mean, I'm going to keep these colors like the way they are? Are you going to rearrange the colors?
I'll probably rearrange them to some extent. I mean, they also might fall out of order.
Yeah, I mean, I was wondering if that was super
natural.
Were the color choices really conscious?
No, I tried to have a light hand in the way that I put things up.
Because it looked like I thought that it was.
Here's something interesting that I discovered.
Dr. Lisa gives a shit. Dr. Lisa gives a shit. Dr. Lisa gives a shit.